This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. In the week when Forest Green Rovers extended their club record unbeaten league run to 18 matches, it is the longest sequence of games without defeat in England's top four divisions so far this season. They are still the only Premier League, Sky Bet Championship, League One, or League Two club yet to taste defeat on their travels. And they are already 16 points clear of the playoff places. And on this week's episode, we'll meet a retiring Sky Bet League One midfielder whose own numbers are equally impressive.
Yeah, it's been a long time. It's gone by in a flash, and I've really cherished and loved every moment of it.
Staying in Sky Bet League One, in EFL Youth Development Week, we'll get under the skin of one of the division's premier talent factories.
I do get great pride, and so do all the staff, when that academy graduate steps from the tunnel onto the pitch for the first time.
And from Sky Bet League Two, we'll talk to one club's top goal scorer of the modern era.
There's still 16 games to go, so hopefully there's plenty more in the tank.
It's the official EFL podcast. So in the Sky Bet Championship, leaders Fulham really are in a league of their own at the moment. It's 5 wins and an unbeaten 6 games for them, scoring 26 goals in the process. They've already scored 2 more collectively than last season's champions Norwich City did in the entire season. And with 30 personally so far, Alexander Mitrovic now needs just one more to equal Ivan Toney's championship record set only last season. Fulham away at Hull this coming weekend. That's a 3 o'clock kickoff on Saturday. Your 12:30 is Huddersfield against Sheffield United. Also at 3 o'clock, QPR visit Barnsley. Luton, who've won 3 of their last 4 unbeaten and are on the cusp of the playoffs, head off to Birmingham. Bournemouth are at Blackpool. Middlesbrough entertain Derby. Nottingham Forest fresh from their FA Cup exertions against Leicester at home to Stoke. And then on Sunday, it's Swansea City against Bristol City. And on Monday, Steve Bruce's first home game in charge of West Brom is against Blackburn. Into Sky Bet League One, where life at Adams Park will never be the same again. At the age of 38 this week, into his 19th year with Wycombe Wanderers, and after 557 appearances, following his single one he made for his boyhood team, Ipswich Town, back in 2003, Matt Bloomfield has finally hung up his boots to concentrate on his role as first team coach. And as sad as the ending is, with some serious messages, Matt, I know you want to impart because you retired on medical advice, I do also want this to be a celebration of a magnificent achievement, mate. I mean, you must be so proud of yourself. That is an astonishing time to have kept play.
Yeah, I think when you're, someone described it to me the other day, when you're having your career and you're in the eye of the storm, as it's been described to me, all you care about is getting in the team, winning football matches, trying to earn promotion. And you don't really have a minute to step back and reflect. And I almost saw it as a little bit of a weakness to step back and reflect, because I always wanted to achieve more and drive myself on. But now it's sort of all said and done. I leave the game with some, you know, my playing career with some incredible memories, some beautiful friendships, some real euphoric highs, along with the really low lows that make up the whole story. But yeah, it's been a long time. It's gone by in a flash, and I've really cherished and loved every moment of it, Clem.
Yeah, I can sense you're on standby waiting for the little bang in your uncomfortable areas, because I have taken the mickey out of you as the old man of the sea and various other nicknames over the course of your career. They're not coming, mate, because I think people underestimate from the outside what it is like. I think I actually put this on a LinkedIn post about you, to keep consistently performing day in, day out, week in, week out, month after month, season after season. It's a real skill, Matt, is it not?
Well, it's very kind of you to say. Thank you. I think one of the things I really cherished as I got older in my career was trying to look for ways to improve. When you're younger, I think you're young, you're fit, you're healthy, and you don't really give it much thought. But as I got into my 30s and everyone was writing me off, we nearly got relegated out of League Two. I got written off by the people that were running the club when the trust owned it 10 years ago, because I had a year out with my groins. And everyone was telling me that the end was coming, and I just knew that the story wasn't finished. I knew that there was something more to come, and I just had something inside me that said I couldn't retire and be content with the rest of my life with how my career had gone to that point. So I just knew I had to find a way and find that fire underneath to really try and achieve something in the last stage of my career. And, you know, there's other contributing factors, Clem. You know, we had the manager, you know, Gareth took over, which helped massively because of my admiration and respect for him. We had people walk through the door like Bayo, who I could not respect and admire any more than I possibly do. The assistant manager, Richard Dobson, who's played a massive part in my life and my career. So, you know, I've been really fortunate with some of the external factors as well, but I just knew deep down that I wasn't ready to finish and I had to find a way to achieve something so I could retire content, which luckily I feel like I've kind of got to that point.
Yeah, some of those names you've mentioned, we could do an entire episode of the podcast just discussing that. You were roommate with Gaz, weren't you, for quite a while, wasn't Gareth?
I was, yeah. What a story that is. I mean, you know,
I can imagine. Is it just one leather jacket he has, or does he have a little collection?
One per day. He has a different one per day. You know, he is as he seems, you know. He used to bring the rock music and the speakers, and we'd be having the music on before games. And then next thing I know, he's manager, and we're having that relationship. But you know, the basic footing was respect, and we started there, and everything else sort of flowed afterwards.
Yeah. I just to give you a warning, in about 10 minutes time, one of my final questions is, amongst the sort of highlights, lowlights and all the rest of it, is who has become your best friend in football? So bearing in mind the names you've already just mentioned, I'm giving you that sort of 10 minute warning. You're going to have to give me one name. How did you feel when you heard the news it was all over, and you realized you were just about to press the button to tell the world?
The hardest thing was writing the statement, because actually I was getting the thoughts out of my head and onto the laptop. And as I was doing so, I was actually replaying so many of the highlights over the years. You know, little things like I've worn that number 10 shirt for, I think, 16 and a half years, maybe. And it's almost become part of me. You know, my girls grew up counting up to daddy's number 10 because that's the shirt I wore. When I was writing about the memories from Wembley on the 13th of July, 2020, you know, you only have to think about those things and it brings all those emotions back. So trying to actually have it in my mind was one thing, but actually saying it out loud and telling people was a really big step because it actually drew a line under it. When I knew myself, but it wasn't out there, it kind of felt like I might be able to play again. And I was almost teasing myself slightly that I could still play, but I knew I couldn't. So dealing with all those emotions was a big thing because, like I've said, I genuinely put my heart and soul into my career. I cherished it, loved it, and put everything into it and achieved as much as I possibly could. So to actually come to the end of what you've tried to do for so long leaves a bit of a gap, but you can fill those gaps with trying to achieve and attain something else, which is what I've luckily been able to throw myself into, of which I feel really grateful for.
How prepared are you, were you, for this moment? Had you been doing a bit of future proofing? I mean, obviously we've met in one of the coaching qualifications or management qualifications you've been doing, but had you been working towards this point for quite some time?
Yeah, I had. When I was 24, I did my ACL. Up until 24, I thought
that's a long time ago, Matt, isn't it?
There was a few years ago, Clem. Up until 24, I thought I was Superman and that my football career was going to go on forever. And, you know, I'd make millions like everybody else, and I'd retire and play golf. But when I got to 24, I did my crew shit, and it was a real eye opener for me that suddenly this could all be taken away. So I did a media degree through the PFA and spent 2 years doing that. Then when I got into my late 20s, I started doing my coaching badges, done my B, done my UEFA A, and I'm currently undertaking a diploma in football management as well. So these plans have been going on for several years. You know, I always thought that if there was ever opportunity in life, the biggest sin would be to not be prepared for it. So if there's a door that's open for you, you've got to be ready to walk through it. And I've loved the game, as you can tell. It's been ingrained in me since the day I went to watch my dad play when I was just old enough to walk. So I always wanted to stay in the game, whether that's through the media, through coaching, management. I never really knew up until the last few years how that might look, but I've been preparing for it because as I alluded to earlier on, I've been fortunate to have a first team coach role now at the club. And had I not prepared for that moment and couldn't take it, then I'd have been kicking myself. So I'm really pleased I did.
Yeah. You mentioned the sort of superhero bit, and you also mentioned you thought you were going to be a you know, one of the millionaire footballers and all the rest of it. Is there a point where you have to come to terms with the fact that you're not going to reach that level, but there is still a very good career to be had, and you stop resenting not reaching that level, and you settle into what has become your life for the last decade and a half?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up an Ipswich Town fan. I came through the academy there, and as far as I was concerned, I was going to play for Ipswich for my whole life, and I was going to be a Championship footballer, and life was going to be great. You know, that day when I got told by Joe Rule that I didn't have a future at the club, and I left to go to Wickham, and I resented Ipswich for a time, in terms of that was my love, my passion, and I couldn't do that. I resented the game slightly because, you know, this was not how it was supposed to be. But, you know, I got to Wickham, and I soon realised that I had two choices. I either put up, or I shut up and did something else. And I was, whatever it was, I don't know what it was, I had something deep inside me that was desperate to create a career in football. And obviously playing in League Two and coming out of contract most summers and dealing with injuries and all the insecurities that comes with it, it's not the lavish lifestyle that we all wanted to live. It's real life, Clem. And I think that really was a tough period in life, in terms of dealing with all those insecurities of the income and how much the income was and what I was going to do after. And I think for my mid-20s, I probably focused a little bit too much on what I was going to do next, because I knew how insecure my job was. It was only once I got to my 30s that maybe I'd managed to enjoy what I was doing a little bit more. And maybe that's part of the reason why I got more out of myself and actually made the most of it, because I couldn't, you know, I could prepare for what was to come next, but I couldn't influence that until it actually came. So, you know, I think also the emotion of getting to the Championship was partly because I'd made peace with myself that I was never going to get there. When I left Ipswich, my intention was to take a step backwards to Wycombe Wanderers and step back up again. But by the time I was sort of mid-30s, I'd made peace with myself that I was never going to get to the Championship. You know, we were in League Two at Wycombe. Then, you know, we had a good season, got promoted up into League One. And for me, that was the crescendo. That was the top. And that was how it was all going to end. And I was going to, you know, elongate that as much as I possibly could. So to finally make to the Championship was kind of a life dream come true, I guess.
You don't have to give me a number here, and you can tell me to go away if you want to. But having played at the levels that you have over all that time we've already discussed, have you done all right for yourself? I mean, you've got quite a big garden behind you. Have you got to sit on lawnmower? This will be a little test. Or do you still do it by hand?
The lads at Wycombe like to tell me that I do, but I really don't know. I've done all right for myself because I've paid my mortgage for the last 20 years, and I've got a wife and two children that I get to support. And I'm extremely fortunate to do a job I've loved to provide that living. You know, the day my football career is finished, I'm working the next day. And that's the reality of the situation. I'm not going to try and pretend there's anything otherwise. It's been a nice lifestyle to pay my mortgage and support my family and take us on a holiday every summer. And that's what it's been. You know, there's no getting away from that fact. And I've saved as much as I possibly can and made some plans for the future. But it's not a lavish lifestyle, and it's not anything like you see on the television. But I'm proud of the fact that I've provided for Mads and the girls, and I have a real deep desire to provide them with a lifestyle that they can enjoy for moving forward.
Did you answer the lawnmower question? The lads obviously take the mickey out of you. You get somebody in to do it, don't you?
I do it myself, and I do it by hand. Fact.
No! That's a big back garden. How long's your back garden? That's a big back garden. I bet sometimes it gets over. I'm not embarrassing you. I tell you what, with the schedule of football as well, and now you're a coach too and things, and you live a little bit of a distance away, I bet there's sometimes your grass is about 6 inches long in the summer, in the back of the... No? Every
no,
Sunday
really
you're
isn't.
Out there, are you?
I'm out and I'm doing my jobs, mate. You should ask my wife. Every time I come home, I've got another list to do, mate. I wish I could kick back and relax on my days off.
We need to have a serious chat, and that chat is that your career was finally over as a result of, well, it feels like a bizarre incident in a game in the League Cup, wasn't it, against Exeter last August. Do you want to Do you want to just take us through it? Because I know you're very keen for football authorities to make some changes, you know, maybe as a result of your own insights and experiences.
Yeah, to give it a little bit of context, I guess I should mention that I've had probably 4 concussions in the last 4 years before August the 10th, 2021. And each one I recovered absolutely fine. Within a few days, I felt great, desperate to get back on the football pitch, but followed all the protocols that led the 7-day return to play, or if I was knocked out, it was longer. But each time I felt absolutely fine, but followed all the protocols. Then we went down to Exeter. I got left out of the first game of the season against Accrington. So I was heading down to Exeter to prove a point to the gaffer, to prove a point to the coaching staff, and to prove a point to myself that at 37, I had another season in me at least. I prepared like I could. I was gutted when I wasn't picked for the first league game of the season. So I went down there to play, to win, to play well and get back in the team. That was my only sort of thoughts. And then we got a free kick on the halfway line. And as we do, we sort of play long from these situations. So I was walking away and JJ tried to take a quick free kick. And by total accident, hit me on the back of the head with a ball that knocked me over. And immediately I knew that I didn't feel great. The world was spinning. You know, I knew where I was and everything. But the doctor and the physio came on and took me off immediately. I was trying to walk to the tunnel and the Wickham fans were just on the right and I kept veering across. And so I knew I was struggling to get straight back to the tunnel. And then the doctor told me after, it's quite narrow at Exeter, and I was sort of hitting both sides of the wall, and I felt agitated, irritated, emotional. I had a headache and dizzy and I knew I wasn't feeling too great. So showing all the signs of a concussion, I guess. And as the doctor told me afterwards, it's not always the head collisions where you're tense and you're waiting for the knock. That was a concussion that you would suffer from, because your body, you know, I was relaxed. I wasn't expecting anything to happen. And my head was really tilted when the ball hit me. So that's what happened. And immediately I knew that I was feeling rough, and, you know, the symptoms lasted a lot longer than what they did before. That week or two that followed, real high fatigue, low energy, you know, things that usually gave me real high delight, you know, weren't giving me such delight. I was struggling to see the light in them. And it was a scary period, Clem, if I'm honest, mate, because, you know, playing a game of football and doing what I loved suddenly put me in a situation when I wasn't feeling too great. And that took a little while for that to resolve. So I'm still got issues sort of ongoing now with my balance. And, you know, when I'm out on the training ground and balls are being kicked around, I'm a bit jumpy and have to be a bit careful where I stand. So, you know, it's something that happened, and I would like to use this opportunity. I don't want it to be a sob story. This is how my career ended. I want, you know, it's an opportunity to raise awareness around head injuries, and to try and help move the game forward, because there needs to be more research out there for footballers. There's not enough research on head injuries, and there needs to be more done. I my personal opinion is that the concussion substitution needs to change slightly. I would like to alter that if I'm ever listened to. And I also think that there needs to be a little bit more education to footballers around head injury, brain injury, because, you know, like, we're very driven people. We're programmed to play through injuries and to get ourselves out there on a Saturday afternoon, because our place in the team relies on it. You know, contracts rely on it, mortgages rely on it, promotions and relegations. But when it comes to your brain health, there needs to be a little bit more education around it, because I for sure didn't want to listen to the doctor. I didn't want to listen to the physio. And I was extremely fortunate that I had 2 people there who cared about me and wanted to do the best by me. But others might not be quite so lucky, and they may need to be a little bit more self-aware.
Do you think there were undoubtedly, over the course of your career, and you mentioned those 4 other concussions quite recently, do you think there have been moments where stuff has been brushed too quickly under the carpet, that sort of old school football mentality of, oh, get on with it, whereas actually you should have been pulled, sat down and kept out for a month or whatever was relevant to the level of injury?
Yeah, definitely, mate. I remember I played a game going back several years, you know, a lot of years, when I first signed for Wickham, and I got knocked out on the Saturday. I sort of collided with an advertising board in, pushed into an advertising board and got knocked out, wanted to come back on, but wasn't, you know, was clearly unable to. Went to hospital that night, got checked over. They said, off you go, go home. I played in the cup on the Tuesday night and had one of my best games. I always look back on it really fondly. One of the best games of my career as I see it, just because of the magnitude of the evening. So that would not be allowed to happen now. There was other instances that you know, for whatever reason I've got myself into scrapes over the years, was with injuries, my knee, my groins, and that incident, and just things have happened. But you know, up until recently, I was absolutely fine. But there does need to be a level of awareness around it, and players need to be protected from themselves. Because I'll be honest, even up until recently, I was still going down the path of, I want to play, I need to play, this is my life, this is my career, this is my livelihood, I need to play. And I had to be protected from myself, and I'm sure that there's others that probably need to as well.
But longer term prognosis, you are being looked after, you are being regularly checked out, you've had whatever scans you need to, there's no nasties in there, you're very much taking care of yourself. Because let's be frank, football's a brilliant game, we all love it, but it's not more important than life itself.
No, I've got, as I said earlier on, I've got a wife and two girls who mean the absolute world to me. And once I realised that I was taking a chance with my future health, and I still had symptoms and repercussions of the last one carrying over, there was, you know, I had a decision to make, but I didn't have a decision to make. There was, you know, I was advised that this is what I needed to do, and this is the process I had to take. So there's a lot of life still to live, and you know, football is a game that we all love, and it seems like it means the world at times, but it's not the be-all and the end-all. And I think at times like this, you have to sort of take a little step back and take a little grasp of reality and realise that it is only a sport. It is an income, but it's only a job. There's other jobs to do. And if the need arises, then you have to go down a different path.
While we're discussing serious issues, as somebody that's been in and around the game for 2 decades now, would you mind if I fire this one past you? Obviously, Bale was involved with an incident of abuse by MK Dons fans the week before last. Very unsafe. I don't know what was said. I've not pried, but we can surmise, we can guess. There seems to be a prevalence of incidents at the moment. We saw Leicester fan run on and punch some celebrating Nottingham Forest fans at the weekend. There was a bizarre incident as a Accrington Stanley stood ready to take a penalty at the weekend, where a Rotherham fan ran out of the crowd, kicked the ball away from the centre spot, barged into the player in question. Is it me, but not only is it getting worse, but I'm finding this hard to describe because I don't want to criticise clubs here, but have we allowed this tribal mentality to prevail in football stadiums for far, far, far too long? It's almost become normalised behaviour that in everyday life, I come up to you in the street and shouted some of those things that you gestured in that way, I'd be reprimanded by the police. Has it got a lot worse, Matt, do you think?
It feels like it seems to be a little bit more often recently. And the sad thing that I think is that, you know, we all missed playing in stadiums where there wasn't any supporters during COVID, and the pandemic was horrible. I hated not having supporters there. I know, you know, the majority of supporters missed coming to the games, and it was a massive loss. And I think we all realised that football is not the same without supporters there, sharing in the delights of a win, being there in the frustrating moments of a defeat, and hitting the post and the despair and the goals going in and the elation. So the game is that special because you share those moments with the supporters, and it's not the same without them. So to come to a period of time, barely, you know, a year later, where supporters are back in the stadium and we're having these incidents is so disappointing. I think what we have to try and remember is that footballers are humans just trying to do a job, and their safety should not be put in jeopardy because of supporter running onto a pitch and attacking someone. It should never happen. The odd isolated incident is part of life, I guess, but to the extent that we're seeing it at the moment, is really sad.
On a happier note, I am going to give you one moment, and one moment only. You've had your 4 promotions, you've had your testimonial where Jose Mourinho brought Chelsea to play and all that. You can take just one moment to replay, and you cannot choose another. Which one is it going to be?
final whistle at Wembley on 13th of July 2020. I've never experienced elation and euphoria like it on a football pitch before in my life, Clem. Without going over things, I think there was a load of contributing factors. I'd been to Wembley once before to play and missed a penalty in the playoff final in League Two with Wickham, and you know, received social media abuse. I got jeered by my own supporters the following pre-season. I carried that and used that as a motivational tool. I'd made peace with myself that I'd never make it to the Championship, and spent, you know, majority of my career in League Two. You know, I knew what it meant for the club to get there at, you know, 133 years, I'd never been to the Championship, and I was sharing in that dressing room with a group of men who I could not speak highly enough of. You know, a lot of us were in the twilight of our careers. You know, Bayo, myself, Darius Charles, JJ, who's obviously still going strong, but was in his 30s at the time. You know, with a real energetic young group of lads as well. And the stars aligned, mate, and we were able to achieve something beyond our wildest dreams. You know, we finished 17th the year before. The budget was then cut. Pete and Rob Coohey came in, literally secured the takeover a month before the pandemic. Had they not taken over, I would, with the trust, even be able to afford to have paid us during the pandemic. Would we have even played in the playoffs? You know, there's all these contributing factors. And then the final whistle goes at Wembley and the emotion pours out, mate. So that's, yeah, undoubtedly one of the highlights of my life, let alone my playing career. Apart from my, you know, my kids being born and marrying my wife, it's right up there, mate.
Yeah, your face lit up when you started to tell me that story. Here it comes then. One and one only. Best friend in football out of all that time. What, 21 years since you left school, is it now?
Nearly 21 and a half years. July 2000, I left school.
Best friend in football. Can't give me two or three to choose from. Have to choose one here and now on the spot. Who are you going to say?
Oh, Clem, I can't choose one. I've made some real close friends. One of my earliest friends from Wickham, Russell Martin, who we shared some real tough times. We lost a teammate. We, you know, John Gorman lost his wife, and we attended two funerals in our club suits together, and there was a group of people there, and we've kept in contact ever since, and we can talk football for hours. Then in the current dressing room, you got JJ, Bayo, the gaffer, one of my closest allies. I could call them, any of those men I could call day or night, anytime, and they would drop whatever they were doing to help me, and I would listen to their advice and respect their opinions.
I'm going to let you off the hook, but only because you're a very old man. Well, you're an old man as a player, but as you have said this week, there it came. It was always coming, wasn't it? But actually, you're now a young man in the coaching and management fraternity, aren't you? So I'm going to have to flip around and call you youngster rather than the elder statesman. Matt, I want to congratulate you. I want to congratulate you on your persistence, on your resilience, but most of all, I want to congratulate you on showing up, because I think it's an underestimated skill, and you have shown the way with bells and knobs on for 20 odd years. Magnificent. Great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Clem. Lovely to see you, mate.
Wickham visit Lincoln City this coming weekend. Just 1.9 for them. Not as bad form, though. Sunderland are currently undergoing. They have lost their last three and still at the time of recording this week's official EFL podcast without a manager. Two form teams go head-to-head. That is MK Dons, 5 wins in 7 against Ipswich Town, 6 in 8 under Kieran McKenna. Oxford entertained Bolton Wanderers. Wigan, who had gone on that incredible 20-match club record unbeaten run, have suddenly lost 2 in a row, 1 in the league following the 1 in the FA Cup. And then on Sunday lunchtime, there's that titanic South Yorkshire derby. It's a 12 o'clock kickoff for Sheffield Wednesday at home to win their last 5, Rotherham United.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
This week is EFL Youth Development Week, where the focus is on the importance and significance of the academy setups at the 72 EFL clubs there. The aim is to ensure that homegrown talent is given the best possible chance to fulfil long-term potential. Every single member of the latest England squad, including the manager, either played in the EFL, came through an EFL academy, or made their debut in an EFL competition. And talking of Gareth Southgate, as I was there, we can talk to Charlton Athletics Academy manager Steve Avery. And quite coincidentally, and I had no idea about this, you were Gareth's PE teacher, Hazelwick School in Crawley. Is this right, Steve?
Yeah, that's right, Mark. Yeah, for a while. I mean, I went to that school in 1986, I think it was. Gareth would have been 15 at the time. And I started there in the summer term. So although football is my passion, and I was a PE teacher, that first term it was all about teaching cricket to Gareth.
How did he fare at cricket?
I can't remember really whether I got him to play for the school cricket team. He was all round good at everything, but he was also a very good athlete. So the summer term was, you know, devoted very much to athletics. And of course, his dad, Clive, I remember, was an athletics coach. So cricket wasn't the easiest sport to convince him, but he had the talent all round for sure. Yeah.
Was there any inkling of what was to follow? That, I mean, either as a player, or also was he showing the leadership skills at that stage that, listen, have been pretty peerless over the last couple of years?
Well, very well respected by, you know, by his schoolmates, with his all-round sporting ability. Football was obviously his big thing, and I remember he was at Crystal Palace at the time. And he'd be off there training a couple of times and playing for them at the weekends as a youth player as well. But of course, he left school then at 16. He would have been academically able for sure and good enough to stay on at school, but he chose that apprenticeship at Crystal Palace and has never looked back.
He damn well hasn't. I mean, this isn't why you're on, by the way. This was just a little side. This was just a little
best
side
vignette.
That came out of the sort of. Believe it or not, we do a little bit of preparation.
Well, there's another one for you as well. I used to teach Dan Walker, BBC presenter, as well.
Did you really?
I don't think I've seen Dan for a long, long time.
But apart from Monday to Wednesday on the TV, yeah. Was he still as tall back then?
He was tall, yeah, like Bambi on ice, I remember, as a footballer. But he's grown into them legs since, yeah.
Yeah, you've said that on the podcast. So the first job I'm doing as soon as we finish this chat is I am WhatsApping Dan just to make sure he's...
In my regards.
I'll do that for definite. So listen, I mean, you have worked at the academy for more than 20 years, and I know in the past you've cited the sort of longevity of the staff working there. Why do you think it's so important to have the same sort of cluster of people around for 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, I think it's absolutely key, Mark, really, because if you're looking to develop a culture of sporting excellence, if you're looking to continue the key messages of learning, the values and beliefs that you're trying to instill and nurture over a period of time, I just think it helps if you've got good people, obviously, quality people that, you know, it's my task to try and retain as well. But if you've got those people there for a number of years, I refer back to my own school days, you know, and the people I think who influenced me, you probably the same as teachers, and they were the ones that you came across for a number of years. And they had a big influence on me and my life going forward and the choices I made career-wise. And I've thought that way very much ever since I've been involved in teaching, and the amount of time that you spend, that I did used to spend on the extracurricular side of sport, the dedication needed there. And when I went to Charlton, I mean, I had no idea I'd be there as long as I have been, 21 years, but I was determined to give it a go and to give it a go and succeed in getting players through to the first team, which is your number one objective. I feel you have to have not just someone like myself, but other key staff in key departments who contribute to that development. They have to be there for a number of years, maybe not 21, but give it a good go, 4 or 5, I always think.
Well, If you're talking culture, then is the greatest compliment we can pay you, and has your biggest challenge been that clearly, in terms of the ownership of the club, lots of first team managers coming and going, you've managed to maintain yourself as an autonomous unit with its own set of intrinsic values that at various times have benefited the first team in terms of flow through?
Well, I feel there's always been a pathway for players to get through at Charlton, which was a factor in me going there in the first place, with my passion for youth development. And although I've served under many managers over those years and three or four different ownerships, I feel that each ownership, despite some trials and tribulations along the way that they may have had, I do feel they've looked towards the academy and had belief in the academy, as it was when I first started. And I remember Richard Murray was the chairman in those days. So the club already had that tradition, I felt, and belief in bringing young players through. And that was a big factor in me going there. And fortunately, the owners and the managers that I've served under have also bought into that as well and looked at our players when need be.
I wonder, Steve, whether it's time we fully acknowledge the importance of the academy manager's role and this sometimes popping up from the academy to first team, or I'm sure you've come across opposite numbers at different clubs where it's somebody that's waiting for their management opportunity. But you're a pretty decent portrayal of a person that very much sees this as a specific career, not an alternative to doing something else.
Yes, I did. I've always seen it that way. I mean, there's been one or two discussions along the way where I've considered the senior environment. But I've come back to really what I feel my strongest skill set was and where my passion lied. And I've continued in that way. And I think a lot of the people around me who have managed to attain that longevity that you referred to, they think likewise.
Has it ebbed and flowed, the sort of opportunities to get players through, some managers being more enthusiastic than others? And obviously, I guess there's a difference between servicing the first team during a mid-table season v servicing them when you're in a relegation scrap or you're fighting for promotion.
Yeah, I think it has ebbed and flowed. I think there has been some challenges, but as I said, I've always felt that we had the players there. I mean, sometimes it comes along through their accidental means, Mark, really, where, say, the first team might have a plague of injuries and then the manager's got to look to see what we've got. And it happens in that way. I think something that I'm working very hard at the moment, you know, with Johnny Jackson and was doing with Nigel Adkins in his short term, was a deliberate strategy, really, and process for getting players through to the first team, so that it's the first team coaching staff, not just the manager, but the coaching staff, all of his staff, who are buying into that individual development plan with the player. And it's not just about, I don't think, appearances. It's also about training minutes, which is something we've looked at very closely, and we've produced statistics around that in more recent times.
You're talking first team squad training minutes.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Whether it be first team squad training minutes, where the players who are on that transition journey, usually it's the under 23s, of course, whether it's those who are on that transition journey, or whether it's just getting those training minutes through training with first team players in, say, small groups. For example, it might be a strikers group, a defenders group, that does that little bit of extra work in an afternoon session or in an early morning session. If we can achieve that, I feel that's what I mean by a deliberate strategy, really. Yeah.
I'm just looking at the list, which I'm sure you've had repeated to you lots of time, but Jonjo Shelvey, obviously Joe Gomez, Ademola Lookman, Esri Konsa. Obviously, you've got a couple breaking through we'll talk about it in a minute. Can you spot the potential straight away? Is there a certain set of characteristics that young players show from a very early age, or are there some very nice happy accidents or pleasant surprises along the way?
I think there are one or two of those along the way. I mean, if I was comparing, say, Joe Gomez and Esri Konsa or a Jonjo Shelvey with an Ademola Lookman, who we only signed when he was 16, Nevertheless, you have to recruit them, even if it's at 16, and that's important because you're nowhere without your recruitment. But the others that I mentioned there, they were on a longer journey. Those names that have just been mentioned, clearly they've got talent, and in some cases they're outstanding athletes as well. So those qualities you do notice. But when I'm referring to those players who are obviously good role models and references for our young players, or even if I'm referring to some players like it might be, for example, a Chris Solly, who made over 250 appearances for us. What I often talk about to, the current crop is the importance of recognising that the talent that you've got alone is not enough, that there's so many other qualities that you need to be able to become the professional footballer. And another thing I always refer to, and sometimes people think it's a given, but when I think of some of these individuals like Shelby, Gomez, Consa, Luckman, they had a great passion for the game. They love training absolutely every day. And it was a joy to take them, for sure. But that from the moment they walked in the gate to the moment they left, you know, you felt they had that passion and dedication, obviously, to become better players.
Do you have an inbuilt kind of radar? And is there a click moment where you know you've got one and you know they're destined for good things? Or again, are there some unpleasant surprises where one goes off the boil just when you think you're going to get them through the eye of the needle?
Yeah, well, it is a journey, isn't it? And you do recognise that. That's why I talk about transition a lot, because there are highs and lows. A player going into the first team, making a few appearances, then having to go back to the 23s. And often it's the academy staff who are the ones who have to pick that up in terms of the holistic care around that, you know. So you have to nurture that and develop that, and get players to recognise that they're still on that journey, but it doesn't just go like, say, a Gomez, where he goes into the first team and he stays there, and 18 months later he's been transferred or whatever it might be. So there is those two very extremes to the journey, I suppose, yeah. And some players are ready at 17, 18, and that's the case, of course, this season with someone like Mason Burstow, but he's still on that journey, very much so. Whereas others, it might take up to 19, 20 for them. That's my belief. And that's why we have an under-23 development squad.
Yeah. I mean, Mason Burstow, obviously, for anybody that missed it, signed for Chelsea on transfer deadline day and loaned back. So when he and Albie Morgan score the two goals in the win over Fleetwood quite recently, is that the prime sort of buzz point for you? Is the buzz point when they make it to the first team squad? Is the buzz point when they move on?
I'm glad you've asked me that, because I do get great pride, and so do all the staff, when that academy graduate steps, you know, from the tunnel onto the pitch or off the bench onto the pitch for the first time. So there's a lot of satisfaction there. But as I often refer to with the players, and even someone like Mason, who's most recent, you know, I feel that they're established pros when they've got 30 or 40 games under the belt. And if that can be for Charlton Athletic, then so much the better. Because I feel then we've done as much as we can, particularly if you're a League One club, and naturally players like the ones we've been talking about are going to capture the attention of the Premier League.
Is selling a real gem occasionally kind of written into the club's economic model? Do you occasionally feel the pressure to help out and move one on?
Mark, I can honestly say I've never been under any pressure. No, I haven't, you know, to do that. I mean, it's happened, of course it has. And it's been explained to me why it's been happening. And of course, there comes a point where I suppose every player, young or old, has got a price on his head, you know, so there does come a point. But what I'm telling you is where I feel my satisfaction and others comes from is if they've become that established professional. So someone like Albie Morgan, he's very much been on a transition journey, you know, but he's been in and around the first team now. Sometimes people forget this, for 3 years or more. But he's obviously had those moments where he's had to be back with the under-23s. He's had one loan that I can recall. But now I feel 50, 60 appearances or starts, he truly is an established first-team player. at the current level. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you keep as keen an eye on the ones that don't quite make it, but maybe dribble down the leagues a wee bit? And and there's some great stories, I think, at the moment of players who sort of fight their way back up from non-league. Do you keep as keen an eye on those as the ones that make it to the top level? And when you see John Joe banging one in from 30 yards on Match of the Day, you feel the same sort of proprietorial sense?
Well, I take a pride in them all. I really do. Particularly the ones I feel who have gone on to play the number of games I've mentioned for our first team. But what I'm noticing, having been at the club so long as well, is, and I'm getting older, of course, you get players like in League One this season. We've been playing Wickham recently and Accrington, and I've noticed a Brandon Hanlon or a Harry Pell. These players who are now in the late 20s in some cases. But, so they're well into their careers. Didn't play, in Harry Pell's case, for example, didn't play any first-team football for us, but he's gone on to have a career. So they're released from the club, whether it's 18, 19, 20, and they have to have that resilience and belief in themselves to come back, and full credit to them. And we try and help them as much as we can. And there's a lot of those around the country, I feel, and even in our first team at the moment, someone like Sean Clare, who's come back to the club. And I think Sean left when he was 15, so why do we release him, you might ask? Please don't. But, great lad, who him and his family, I believe that, he could succeed elsewhere, and he has done. And then, not so long ago, we had Ariata, who came back on loan. And although Harry's gone back now, and I think Harry played two or three games for the first team, that was all, before he was released. So there's a lot of those dotted around, is what I'm saying.
There's been a sort of a move from the PFA, I think, to try and educate young players. The sort of flow-through rate is not what I guess everybody would hope it would be. Do we have a responsibility, do you think, to try and prepare them for life outside football, because it's not going to happen for all of them, or is it still entrenched that you have to keep your eye on the prize at all times and not consider the possibility you might not make it?
I think the possibility has to be considered, and that's why the player care programs that are happening in clubs and very much supported by the EFL, of course, and LFE program. And we're very proud of the player care program that we operate at the moment, and we only hope to grow it really going forward. So we spend a lot of time, particularly through the scholarship years, 17, 18 and post 18 as young professionals, preparing them for, first of all, I feel the personal qualities that are needed, whether it's in the game or outside of the game, as well as educating them around other possibilities, particularly when it comes to that awful moment that a player is released as well.
And similarly, how do you manage family expectations? Because quite clearly, sometimes a player who breaks through and make it can change the lives of not just himself, perhaps his siblings, perhaps his parents, perhaps grandparents there. So what do you do in terms of communication with parents and trying to stop excessive pressure on a bright young talent?
Well, I think that's non-stop, Mark, really, throughout the academy years. And I probably feel we have most impression on parents who have been with us on the longest journey. So those who have been with us since 9, 10, 11, for example, because throughout those years, we'll have many informative evenings with parents. I mean, we'll have an annual parents evening, first of all, to explain current trends, maybe current messages that we want to get over, as well as a pile of admin in relation to the season. But throughout the season, we'll hold different programs, different CPD events, if you like, for parents as well. You're always asking them to buy into our expectations and understand our expectations and educate them around our expectations. That contact with parents is vital. Likewise, contact with schools as well. But in particular, I think we pride ourselves on the relationship we have with parents and making ourselves approachable, really. I've got a great message from Joe Gomez's dad that I use at parents' evenings where he thanks the academy so much for everything they did for his son. But really, it's a message to the parents, asking the parents to support the academy, believe in the academy, and do everything we ask of them in terms of the commitment needed, you know.
Obviously, you've got clubs on the ground in terms of Palace and Millwall as potential rivals. I think there's an increasing awareness of just what a brilliant sort of catchment area South London is too. There's a lot of other clubs kind of, maybe not at the impressionable younger age. I wouldn't want to mislead people there because obviously there are territories and stuff, but it's obviously a hotbed. What is it that you do that keeps you ahead of the competition is, I guess, my question.
Well, I don't know whether we stay ahead of the competition. I mean, it is very competitive for sure. I mean, our recruitment department would not compare with some of the, you know, the resource of our department would not compare with some of the London clubs for sure. There's undoubted talent in terms of the demographic of the area. And we try and tap in particular to those areas that are closest to us. So ensuring that we're active, with our program of recruitment, particularly in areas like Greenwich, North Kent, East London, South London, is crucial. But as I said, we've got a small team of people, and I'm forever grateful to people like, you know, my head of recruitment, Bert Dawkins, who's been with us again. You talk about that longevity, who's been with us in two different spells and does a fantastic job with a small team of people in convincing parents that and players that Charlton is the academy for their son. I think what helps as well, Mark, is that with the success we've had and the productivity, is that it perpetuates itself, if you understand me. And, you know, our facilities will not compare with the likes of some others. We know that. But we're a welcome environment and we're a caring environment. And I think that message is out there, as well as the fact that we're developing young players.
Steve, you've been doing it a long time. What is it that keeps you going?
The satisfaction that I've had throughout the years, the passion of the game, because I love the game. I really do. I was a teacher, as we've alluded to, but football was my sporting passion in particular. And so I developed myself as a coach. I've never lost that enthusiasm for coaching. Still out there on the grass two or three times a week. And it's difficult to turn my back on it, in all honesty, Mark. Yeah.
Listen, keep up the great work. I have loved that chat. So We'll keep a very keen eye on what you're up to and watch who's coming through next. It's been great to talk to you. I've got to go. I need to go and message Dan Walker. Dan, what was it you described him as? Bambi on ice?
Yes, yeah, that'll do. It was also, I think, telling him that the opening batsman for the school cricket team. He did play cricket. Yeah.
There you go, you see. There's an advantage with those long legs, isn't there? Steve, lovely to talk to you.
All the best. Thanks, Mark.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Into Sky Bet League 2. And let's finish this week by talking to Dom Telford, who already this season has become the first Newport County player to score 20-plus league goals since John Aldridge did it over a decade before Dom was born. And I guess, Dom, I want to know how much you're aware of the history books and stuff like that. You know, as you've gone around your various clubs, do you kind of drill down into who's done what, who's gone before? And were you aware of that fact about the mighty John Aldridge?
To be fair, I wasn't. It was only after the game, you know, when I found out. I think when I came in pre-season, 20 goals was... when I came in January and came back, you know, pre-season and the start of the season, I was completely out of favour. So 20 goals wasn't my, you know, my benchmark or my target. So, you know, it was just a case of, you know, taking it game by game and ticking them off. And there's never really a point in the season where you, you know, you get a chance to reflect sort of thing. But it was nice for, you know, me and the family that night, you know, hearing that. And I think there's still 16 games to go, so hopefully there's plenty more in the tank.
Ah, but there you've given me a little hint, you see, about strikers and target setting, because you mentioned there, take, well, I guess when you're not in a red hot streak, you take it one game at a time. But I bet you when you are in a red hot streak, as you've been on, you do start, okay, I've got to 20. Oh, and it's 21, obviously, with one you got in the cup. Yeah. Right, next target's 25. Do you need targets when you're in a hot streak to give you something to focus on?
A lot of people have said that to me, like, sort of, you know, every time I've scored this season. And I've sort of had the mentality of still having that game by game, the way of I'm going into it, because I scored my first, my first 10 quite quick. And I think coming from where I was at in pre-season, sort of taking it day by day as such, not really knowing where I'd be or what my future held, and then sort of having that day by day, game by game mentality, I thought, you can get quite carried away by thinking, oh, I'll get 5 this month, or I'll do this and do that. And I just, it worked for me doing that game to game, and I don't want to change that now, because, it's worked for me so far. And, playing in the team that I'm lucky enough to be playing in, we're creating loads of chances. And it's just a pleasure to be playing in at the minute.
Can you describe for those of us that will never experience it, what it is like for a striker when that ball crosses the line and you see the net rippling? Can you put it into a sentence for us, or a series of feelings and emotions?
That's a very good question. I've not really ever had anyone ask me that.
Is it a physical sensation?
It's
is
very
it a
hard
tingle?
To describe, but the feeling is one that you can never replace, no matter what. No matter what you try and do, you're never going to replace it. It's almost like for that 5 seconds, 10 seconds afterwards, it's just it's almost like all them years of putting the hours in, even as a kid, and you when you're scoring in your back garden or on the field or in training, then when you're a bit older, and then in a U team game, or when it, and even now during the week, I try and make a habit of it, Monday to Friday, and then when it comes off on a Saturday, it's just there's literally no feeling like it. So I'd love to be able to explain it to you.
Well, no, but I think your smile explains it, and the fact I would think it is probably quite difficult to do. Describe an emotion, but I guess the opposite side of that is, obviously, you and the boys been on a nice little run, 4 in a row, then lost a couple in a row, and you haven't scored. At what point in those last two games, at what point does not scoring start to niggle you? Is it 2 games? Is it 3 games? Is it 5 games when it's there and the little chatterbox is in your head all the time going, ooh, you haven't scored for a while?
I think it's... like I said, when you're scoring and you're still taking it game by game, if you're on a streak where you're not scoring, taking it game by game is the best way to, it keeps you sort of level. And I think you should only really worry when you're not getting the chances, or, your team aren't creating and you're not. Then you can, really look at yourself and think, right, what can I do to, I need to be having an impact on the game here. But I think, Northampton's keeper on Tuesday night made a couple of great saves. So I'm not, I'm not worried. I'll always back my ability. And it's just, like I said, whether it's good or bad, it's game by game, and dusting yourself off, recovering right, sleeping right, eating right, and going again.
Yeah, there's probably a life lesson in there for all of us, isn't there, about trying to live in the here and now and not overthinking it. Football heroes growing up, who did you watch a lot of? Who inspired you? Who might you have based your early game on?
So my dad's a Geordie. So of course Alan Shearer. He was, he was someone who I always looked up to. And then sort of as I got a little bit older and didn't get to too many football games because I was playing on the weekends and stuff like that. Jermaine Defoe, I think the way he lit up the Premier League every year, and he wasn't, well, still, you know, he still isn't the tallest of strikers, but, you know, he was doing it at a time where it wasn't really a thing to have, you know, small play. Everyone wanted, you know, big lads, and, you know, it was, I was only smallest, but even smaller growing up, and I was seeing him, you know, almost against the odds, proving to people that if you're good enough, it doesn't matter how tall you are or you know how strong you are, or you know, he was and still is a top finisher and had a great career. So I used to love watching him and still watch, you know, the clips of his goals now, and definitely learned a lot off him.
How tall are you, Dom?
depends if I've got my trainers on with an extra inch. Oh,
thank God. I thought you were going to say your high heels or something. 5 foot what?
five foot eight and a half. I've got to have that half in.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, as you've moved around your clubs, Blackpool, Stoke, Bristol Rovers, Bury, Plymouth, before getting to Newport. I mean, the feeling to be in a club where it seems to be the right fit, that must be the utopia, isn't it? That must be what any striker aims for.
Definitely, yeah. And I think it's a mixture of things that sort of come together. You know, you've got to have the trust in, you know, and the players have got to have the trust in you. So the staff, you know, especially, you know, when you come to a new club, if you're on a bit of a dry patch or you're not hitting the ground running as such, you know, it was tough for me at Argyle. You know, I was injured when I first went, and it was a case of not really hitting the ground running. But you know, I've come here, and you know, the fans really get behind you, and you know, we play a type of football which suits me, creates chances, and yeah, it's, like I said, it's game by game, but it's, you know, it's enjoyable, and it's a good working environment, and you know, you enjoy going to work every day.
Yeah. Has the change of manager from Mike Flynn to James Roper, has that made much of a difference from your point of view?
Yeah, massive. You know, he's an ambitious manager. He's you know, it's his first job, so he's, you know, he's learning, and I like his you know, tenacity, and that, you know, he wants to succeed. He wants better for himself and us as a collective, and you know, he wants to. There's always more, which, you know, I'm similar. You know, my mentality is similar, and when you've got a group and staff that have that same mentality of you know, wanting to push for more, and you know, especially because he does it in the right way, he plays, you know, he wants us to play a nice style of football, and but still do the ugly side of it. And yeah, you know, he's definitely helped me a lot, and you know, trusting me to do the business. I mean, if it wasn't for him, I definitely wouldn't have scored you know, all them goals. So we've still got a long way left to go, but we're positive, and we're dusting ourselves down and taking it game by game.
Yeah, I mean, as a neutral, I'm loving the top of League Two at the moment. But I mean, it's remarkable, you know, when you see a run, say, for example, that Mansfield have been on to come into contention, and then somebody that's like won four or five in a row. You've just had the experience of doing fours. I think Northampton did, then won just one in six. It's remarkable the way teams' form is ebbing and flowing this season.
Yeah, you know, that's League Two for you. It's a crazy league, but that's why it's sort of game by game mentality, because literally anyone can beat anyone. You can't take anyone lightly. You've got to respect, you know, what each team brings and put the work in during the week for that individual team, because, you know, there's 24 teams, and everyone plays a slightly different style. So yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'd prefer it if everyone was getting beat around us, but yeah, there's a few good runs, a few good runs getting strung together by a few teams, and yeah, we're, you know, obviously we'll opt to kick back on and bounce back from Tuesday night.
Yeah, will your own personal future depend on which division Newport are in next season?
I think, you know, that's a tough question to answer just yet, because, you know, I've had it in the past where it's been something that I've let, you know, bother me, thinking too far into the future. So, you know, I've spoke to the manager and my agent, and, you know, I trust the people around me, and, you know, we'll do the right thing in due course. But for now, it's, you know, we've got a busy period, and we need to just focus on the Saturdays and the Tuesdays, and you know, that other stuff will hopefully take care of itself.
You are as impressive with your words off the field as you are with your feet and head on it. Great to talk to you, Dom. Good luck for the rest of the season.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak to you, mate.
Your Sky Bet League 2 fixtures this coming weekend: Exeter, who are currently sixth, travel to Bradford City. Mansfield, remember when they were just above the relegation zone? Now, after 9 league wins and unbeaten 10, they're just 3 points off an automatic promotion place. They're at Bristol Rovers. Dom's Newport County, currently seventh, entertain Oldham Athletic. 2 consecutive wins since John Sheridan returned. The Chesare is on. Port Vale, who are eighth, entertain Northampton Town, who are third. It's fourth against the leaders at Gander Green Lane. That's Sutton United against Forest Green Rovers. And Walsall, who have sacked Matt Taylor after 7 consecutive defeats. They'll have Neil McDonald and Matt Sadler in the dugout, are 21st and 4 points above the relegation zone. They entertain second place Tranmere Rovers. That's it for this episode. A big, big thank you to Dom Telford, to Steve Avery, and to Matt Bloomfield. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. It's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.